going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast, and we got to go deep on all things Four Nations. I traveled to Boston, and the city was on fire. So many hockey events throughout the week, and obviously culminating in the game of the year thus far. It's going to be tough to top that. Canada winning, as you know, obviously in overtime. And we're going to talk about Four Nations, the week that was, the initiatives that happened, and the big game and what it means for the country. And we've got best on best. Again, Canada wins their fourth straight best-on-best competition. We have to wait 9 years for one. They're now 4-1 all-time versus the USA. There's so much tension, not just in the hockey world, but in the world and online between these two nations and their fan bases. And there certainly was a lot of tension in the arena. And we have another moment, another heritage moment. You go to 1976 and Sittler's goal, Lemieux in 87 from Gretzky. Obviously, the golden goal, 2010, on home soil with Crosby. But this one is for this new generation of the new generational star, Connor McDavid, in 2025 at the Four Nations. And got to say, they picked the team correctly. 14 Stanley Cup winners, and they were winners. And they ended up winning. And shout out to Nova Scotia, who without that province, we are certainly not as strong as a nation and certainly not as strong as a hockey nation. 6 goals, 10 points from the Nova Scotians. So have some donaires, jump up, be excited. I'm so excited for Italy. Before we really do a deep dive on this tournament, I want to look back at how we got here, why this tournament is even a thing, and how we settled on 4 teams. And no better person to do that than senior writer right here at Sportsnet, Ryan Dixon. We go deep on Four Nations with Ryan Dixon.
And off the drop, McDavid went forward, and here we got a shot on. McCarr sends it around. Marner waiting. Connor McDavid scores! Connor McDavid for Canada!
We know as Canadian players, the only outcome that is acceptable is a gold medal. You know, so we don't come into tournament hoping to get to the finals or hoping to get to the medal round. It's gold or bust.
Every player in that room is proud to be a Canadian. And yeah, did we need a win? Not only like our team, but Canada needed a win. This one was different. This wasn't a win for themselves. This was a win for 40 plus million people. The guys knew it, and they delivered.
So, Dixon, thank you so much for doing this. And I have to say, I was one of those who was not a hater, but I would put me in the skeptical camp because I just didn't know if a made-up tournament without Russia in the middle of this season was going to hit. But best on best, once again, is the best. I still feel like I'm scarred from that, was it under-23 team that just was thrown together and didn't really make a lot of sense. But this did make sense and was the talk for the last week and a half. Before we get to the game and what it meant for the country, your biggest takeaways on Four Nations, which we might never say again after this, was what?
You're right. I assume this is the last time we will say those words. I wasn't a skeptic, but in a million years, I didn't expect this. And, you know, Lord knows I don't have the stomach for a debate on fighting in hockey, but I think we knew even when Canada played that, like from puck drop against Sweden in the first game, you're like, okay, this is on. Then the U.S. played Finland the next day. You already knew it was on. And then, you know, 9 seconds in to a Canada-USA game, we've got 3 fights. I've been watching hockey a long time. I've been watching international hockey a long time. I mean, honest to God, I was racking my brain in that moment being like, have I seen 3 international fights in my life, let alone in 10 seconds? and it just went through the roof. The reason I wasn't a skeptic was just because, specifically when I looked at the sched and saw Canada v. USA Saturday night in Montreal, I just knew the all other contacts didn't matter at that point. The Team USA players and the Team Canada players were going to absolutely go at each other and go for it in that game. I knew that. I fully understood that. I just didn't know, you know, would there be large chunks of unsold seats in the Bell Center or whatever, you know? Like, I didn't necessarily know what the, you know, how to what degree people would embrace it. And obviously we learned it wasn't just the players who were all in, it was everyone. So in terms of a takeaway, I mean, speaking to that, you have to say, you know, clearly everyone was just starved for this. I mean, that was the other thing, was it had been 9 years since we got a tournament like this. And you're right, like, you go back to that 2016 World Cup, kind of gimmicky. You know, Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews are playing on the same team against Team USA and against Team Canada. Like, you know, just didn't feel like what we were used to. And so even if this was a scaled back version of that, you know, the Finns, the Swedes, the Canadians, the Americans, were all, you know, I think just dying to wear their country's colors. And we've got a whole generation, basically, of U.S. players who now think and believe, and largely rightfully so, that, you know, they're on even footing with Canada. But as much as Canada comes in with the reputation of having won all the best-on-best tournaments and, you know, have won three in a row, it's also stacked with players who haven't had this experience. So it's not like, oh, you just won the cup back-to-back years and naturally there's a little hunger that's declined. Like Canada, Connor McDavid and Nathan MacKinnon and all those guys who haven't worn Canada's colors in a best-on-best, they were as hungry as the U.S. guys. And even guys like Crosby and Marchand haven't done it for a decade. So they were bringing that to the mix. So I just really felt like you just saw how desperate everyone was for this again. And yeah, I mean, my takeaway is Team USA is going to probably win one of these things somewhere down the line for sure. So enjoy this one. But Canada is right there as well, or not right there, still on top. And I don't think is going to necessarily be easily moved off the top perch, because you look at, you know, who's really driving the bus on this. It's guys who are still going to be good for the next 3, 4, 5 years. So it is incredible to think in some ways that this was just the appetizer for re-entry into having regular international best-on-best hockey.
Yeah, we know we're going to get the Olympics in Italy in a year. We're going to have a World Cup after that. So we'll max wait 2 years for best-on-best. I have more of a procedural question before I follow up on the actual events of the tournament. Do we know how we settled on four teams? Like, if I'm the Czechs, or if I'm the Slovaks, or even, quite frankly, Germany, I understand it had to be exclusively NHL players because it was not a double IHF event in the same way it was really an NHL event. But do we have an understanding of how they landed on these four teams?
Well, I mean, I certainly think if you power rank the hockey nations in the world, these are the top four. And I think it was just intended to be a scaled down event that was going to, like I said, you know, kick off re-entry into international hockey. So when they came up with this, I guess, about a year ago, or announced it at least a year ago, I mean, a year sounds like a long time to plan a tournament, but by the same token, I think they were looking at it saying, what can we do around this time next year, that knowing we're going to have a longer break in our schedule in an Olympic year, what can we squeeze into, you know, whatever it was, 10 days. Obviously, the more teams you have, the larger scale it becomes, the bigger the round robin has to get. Suddenly you're at maybe a full 2 week break. I just don't think there was necessarily an appetite, and maybe truly, like, not, like, logistically speaking, not enough time to understand exactly how it was going to work if you were going to have a full blown World Cup where, you know, they're saying in 28, it's going to be eight teams, which is great. And obviously the way it should be. I just think, I mean, honestly, the way the public, you know, was sort of skeptical about it, like, who knows? Maybe the NHL didn't even take it that seriously and just wanted, you know, maybe the original conception was like, well, it'll be a glorified all-star break. We don't need to get every country involved. We just need to show that international hockey's coming back, and hopefully we can sell some seats and, you know, bring these four countries that are the top four countries. I'm excluding Russia because obviously it's banned from double IHF play right now. And I know this wasn't double IHF play, but, you know, I think the likelihood that Russia was going to be invited to this or be a fourth team, you know, they probably weren't going to bump a Sweden or Finland given, you know, the entire context of the situation. But at any rate, they can look at these four countries and know they can all ice a competitive team. And even Finland, which was severely undermined on the back end, you know, more or less held its own. So I just think, you know, again, it was sort of a thrown together thing, and they wanted to keep it, you know, somewhat manageable. So you end up with four teams, and who knew that it would turn into what it did.
Well, you talked about the context earlier, and I think there's two huge factors that gave us sense of what we got. You mentioned the time that we had to wait, 2016, that World Cup in Toronto, essentially almost a decade before we had best on best again. And geopolitically, what's happening between our country and our allies, in air quotes, in the South, and the lead up to conversation of tariffs, grocery stores putting Canadian flags around food, and people thinking of supporting local. I almost personally believe the latter supercharges thing in a way, even superseding the former in the amount of time. But what say you?
I will not disagree with that. I mean, I just think it added a layer. For the players themselves, I think they're out there laying it on the line no matter what. But I certainly think for the Canadian public watching at home, the backdrop of everything that's gone on and just, you know, truly dovetailed with this tournament, you know, in terms of things seeming to get kicked up to another level. Yeah, absolutely. I think this became a win Canadians wanted far more than if it was just a regular tournament or, you know, if there wasn't the, you know, exactly what you outlined going on in the political world. There's no question it added a lot. And I think the players, you would have seen what you saw regardless, but obviously it does ratchet it up when the anthem gets booed by Canadians. Now Americans are, you know, swinging extra hard and Canada's responding to meet that. So it probably did nudge the intensity up on the ice a bit as well, because I don't know if you see, you know, three fights right off the bat, if it isn't, you know, I'm sure in the minds of the American players, some kind of response to the welcome, quote unquote, that they got in Montreal and had been seeing in NHL rinks for a couple of weeks leading up to it. So absolutely, that stoked the fire a huge amount. And I think is, you know, part of the reason that Canadians are feeling extra satisfied, I would suspect, ever since McDavid put that one over Hellebuck's glove hand. So yeah, no question. I agree with you 100% that the wait was a big deal, but I think everything going on right now superseded that and absolutely took it to another level.
To the tournament, I felt like Binnington was essentially auditioning for this crease in Italy. Throughout the tournament, people felt like he might be auditioning to keep his spot, but he goes from theoretical liability to potential MVP. What do you make of what he's done for himself, a stature in the game and the program over the last week and a half?
Well, he's certainly done a lot for the section of the sports watching, sports, even managing, sports observing and writing community that believes in the concept of a winner, right? Like, to some, that's sort of been a debunked myth or, you know, something that is, a relic from the past ways we used to talk about athletes in sports and what have you. You know, it seemed like it was a lot to hang your hat on that. Oh, hey, 6 years ago, he had a great game in here in game seven against the Bruins when he won the Stanley Cup with the Blues. But my goodness, I mean, they clearly believe not just in his mentality, but his ability. And like, that's the thing, is as much as we're going to, you know, laud him for the way he stuck with things, you know, Kelly Rudy, watching the broadcast throughout the week, mentioned over and over how, you know, Binnington is known as a hothead. And obviously people were trying to get in his kitchen, and the Americans specifically were whispering whatever they could in his ear to try and make him lose his mind, and even bumping into him in that final game. He just never did. He stayed on path. But listen, you don't make those saves that he made in overtime without incredible athletic ability. Someone asked me after the Finland game, if Canada wins, is it Binnington's job at the Olympics? And I was like, no way. Like, you can't look at it that way, given the way he looked through three games in the tournaments. Obviously, you know, he was going to help his case if they won, but I didn't think there was anything he could have done Thursday night that made you go, boom, there's the game one starter for the 2026 Olympics. I would say I'm revisiting that notion right now. I mean, there's still a long time to go between now and then, but clearly his showing in that game gives him the inside track. You know, other people have basically a full calendar year of NHL play to, you know, to try and get in there. But I think if put it this way, if they put as much stock as they did in what Binnington had done, you know, specifically in the 2019 playoffs, as they did at this event, I mean, how much then are they going to put in what he did at the Four Nations when, you know, only really whatever it's going to be 10 months later, it's time to name a team. I mean, obviously it's going to be a huge amount. So what a satisfying moment, even if he probably wouldn't acknowledge it. It had to be for him personally to know there was all this chatter out there, and certainly justifiably. I mean, you can just look at the numbers. I mean, Jordan Binnington is a good NHL goalie, but he's certainly not at the top of the craft. And, you know, there were other guys who at least seemed like decent options to give a rip to. You know, Aiden Hill is a winner as well. He won the Stanley Cup with Bruce Cassidy in Vegas, and Cassidy was one of the guys on the bench helping coach this team. Like, you know, I was surprised Hill didn't get a look somewhere just to see if they could capture lightning in a bottle. But certainly to hear Cooper tell it, they were never wavering. And my goodness, was that faith ever justified or rewarded, because he was really good in sit for 60 minutes and he went to an absolute other level in the extra time.
I'm a prisoner of not just the moment, but future moments. And I can't just enjoy what I have right now, because I'm not going to lie, the entire tournament I'm watching and I'm thinking, okay, what players are not here can I envision playing at this level that could be additive in Italy? Hyman, Wilson, Celebrini, Bedard. I'm trying to envision, could they skate at this level? Could they play at this pace? So for you, if there are any additions to this team, who do you think might be on that inside leg to make a difference?
Well, I mean, my first answer is a bit of a cheat, but I think we can safely say Thomas Harley is going to be a full-time player next time around. He's not going to be an injury replacement. He looked so smooth out there and, you know, formed a great pair with Doughty. And I thought Doughty had his best game in the final, but, you know, Harley is 23. And absolutely, I think you can bank on him being a member of the defense corps next time around. I mean, I do think a guy like Wyatt Johnson, Harley's teammate in Dallas, is another guy we could be saying, like, wow, I didn't know how good this guy was. I mean, he's had a little bit of a step back in terms of production this year as a third-year NHLer than what he had last year when he was, you know, a 30-goal scorer. But, I mean, he has shown in the playoffs already what a player he can be. And, I, you know, you're always kind of trying to strike that balance, and you're seeing the hand-wringing on the American side of, like, you know, picking the – everyone's a super skilled player, but, you know, a quote-unquote role player or guys who can fill certain roles versus, like, give us our best players. And I just think Johnson is one of those guys who he certainly presents as someone who you could throw on the bottom six, and he can do, not only can he bring some offense, but he can do the stuff required down there to when you're lining up against key big time players trying to kill a penalty, or when you're just trying to get it over the, you know, get a game into the end zone over the 1 yard line, and you need those super smart defensive smothering players. I just think by next January, he could be a guy who I think, you know, gets a lot of attention. I mean, for sure, Bedard and Celebrini, it's wild to think, like, I think Macklin Celebrini will still be 19 next February. So that, you know, it seems a little crazy that he would be there. But honestly, he has a lot of what I was saying about Johnson. I mean, when Celebrini was coming into the NHL, when we were talking about him being the first overall pick, if anything, he wasn't getting the comparisons to, you know, the super high-end offensive players like the way Bedard was positioned. It was more like, think more Jonathan Toews, and who's been more important to Canadian hockey moments in the past 15 years than Jonathan Toews. You know, if he's doing what he's doing as a rookie again next year, he too has that makeup where you might not have him as a top six guy, but he could be an incredibly skilled player you could have who's still, you know, is able to play just a really, really sharp 200-foot game. So there's another guy. I mean, you have to think Logan Thompson, you know, he signed an extension with the Capitals. He's been, I would think off the top of my head by the numbers, the best Canadian goalie this year. He's going to get a long look to come in there. And, you know, Binnington's clearly on the team, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Johnson there as well. And we have to talk about Bedard. I mean, I know he hasn't popped the way people expected offensively, but, I mean, playing on the team he's playing on, if you dig into a bit, I mean, he is certainly still doing very well for a guy who is yet to have his 20th birthday. I mean, would anyone be surprised if in year three in the NHL, you know, Bedard became one of the more menacing scoring threats out there? I don't think so. I think there's absolutely a world where he could be on there. So, you know, there will be some turnover, as hard as it is, you know, 12 hours after a group of guys went out there and won, you know, the game of their lives, really, for many of them. And as well as they performed top to bottom, you know, there will be some churn for sure. And yeah, some of those guys we've touched on, I think absolutely will be big challengers for a spot at the Olympics.
I'd be remiss if I let you go without asking about, to me, what this tournament, what this victory was about, and that's 1A, 1B, MacKinnon and McDavid, guys who we've seen them dominate playoff series in the past and both get to finals and MacKinnon winning one, but they play in the middle of the night. They don't play in maybe the most sexy markets. No disrespect, Edmonton. But for millions of people on both sides of the border to sit and watch them intently and see obviously the flashes, but the nuances in their game and the brilliance, I thought was really cool. The MVP, and in terms of McDavid, the MCP, the most clutch player, what do you make of them announcing themselves on this stage for the first time in this generation?
Well, I'll start with the MacKinnon and say, right before the tournament, I had written something about one of the last games, maybe the last game he played before the break, Colorado went into Edmonton. They won, I think, 5-4, and he had whatever, you know, a goal and two assists or something like that. Obviously, he's the reigning MVP. He could be again this year. He could win his first scoring title this year. You know, I was putting out there in that way you sometimes do in sports media an argument that, like, look, is my heart really, really in this? Probably not, but you know what I mean when I say we could leave this tournament, in a sense, talking about him as the best player in the world because of the level he's gone to in the NHL the past couple of years, you know, where he's at in his career in terms of just ability to dominate the games the way he can. Like, if he goes there and has a huge tournament, you know, is he, if you consider best player in the world, some kind of nebulous mix of resume combined with ability combined with huge moments, then, you know, MacKinnon had a chance and basically did all he could, all you could ever ask of him, leading the tournament with 4 goals, being named MVP, as you said. But on the flip side, obviously McDavid kind of had the exact opposite final experience where, you know, last night I was giving grades to every Canadian player, and you know, halfway through the game, I was just starting to have a strange internal conversation about, like, what's the lowest grade you can give Connor McDavid? Like, he just didn't have it, or wasn't, you know, just wasn't there for him because of the smothering D they were playing. It felt like everything was just on and off his stick, or just a little behind, or, you know, he wasn't having the game we were used to seeing from him, to say the least. But he got one look and he made it count. And I think, you know, he is the best player in the world. Let's be real. There's just no one you could take ahead of Connor McDavid if he had to go out there and win a game. And, you know, I said last night, and I think it stands, like, that instantly became the signature moment of his career, right? I mean, as incredible a work as he's done along the way, and, you know, winning the Stanley Cup is such a different beast because of it. It's a 2-month just war of attrition, and, you know, it's just a very different context than coming to, you know, going to two cities for 10 days and playing 4 games and winning. But by the same token, you know, when we talk about Sidney Crosby and everything that's gone into his legacy, you know, front and center in that is, Sidney Crosby didn't have a good tournament in 2010. You know, I'm sure some people remember, he kind of wasn't feeling it. And then boom, you know, Iginla to Crosby, and it's in the net, and it's the golden goal. And that is part of the, you know, the makeup of being that player. So McDavid, you know, completely undoes any negativity from the first, whatever it was, 72 minutes or whatever, 68 minutes of the game, where he didn't quite have it, by bearing when it counted. So I do think you're right. You know, I mean, we saw McDavid go to the final with the Oilers. That's a Canadian team many Canadians are tuned into. If anything, probably McKinnon's stock in, you know, in the general viewing public, it probably rose more because you saw he's basically every bit as good as McDavid when he gets the puck and is dashing in toward the opposing end. Like, I don't know what you do as a defenseman, because his ability to go by you or to just pull up and, you know, create so much space for himself with his speed. They're both just incredible. And there were really good players in that game last night. And, you know, Brady Tkachuk was in the middle of everything. Dylan Larkin really stood out for the Americans, but there's still no two guys in the world like those two guys. When they've got a head of steam and they're hitting the blue, you really feel like every time something can happen. So again, started to bring it back to this notion that we're just getting started here with the international hockey. I mean, McKinnon turns 30 in September, but, you know, I think it's fair to expect he's going to be playing at this level for 2-3 more years. And Connor McDavid is still firmly in his 20s. So as much as it's been a crime that these guys haven't represented Canada to this point in their already long NHL careers, it's good to know, you know, get used to seeing them. You're going to see a bunch of them in the next handful of years, which is great.
It is great. Can't wait. Counting down the days already to the Olympics in Italy, where we can do this all again and dream of the line pairings again, and can't wait to see both of them go for a run in the cup in the West, because we're not that far away from that either. It's a great time to be a sports fan. We will continue to follow and read you as you give us the great perspective and analysis along the journey. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Ryan. And I loved Four Nations. And I love the fact that it dominated the sports conversation over the last weekend and a bit. And I think the NHL hit this out of the park. And if we're going to criticize them when they miss, we have to give them love when they connect. As we go to break, here's my essay on Four Nations and what a success it's been.
Boston, the stage perfect for international duels, is a city known for revolutionary wars, for higher education, and for hoisting trophies. Lots and lots and lots of trophies. So it's only fitting the first Four Nations is here. As we all get a lesson on how good international best on best is.
He's in. Marner. It's Marner.
And hand out some hardware to recognize the nexus of national pride and international supremacy. some regular season foes become line mates, the Nova Scotians, who have all individually brought the cup home, linked up to try to bring the gold home and made this city their home away from home. The Bash brothers showed brotherly love, but no love lost.
Old rivalries that were on pause are reignited.
Sadly, there's only one thing missing. We all show love to Johnny Hockey. This is a mid-season break, but it's far from rest and relaxation. It's rough and relentless. And the four-leg sprint is on the anchor leg. There's just two teams and one game left. Stakes, storylines, stars, and a flag. The combination is undefeated. As much as we've craved this for some time, it's clear the players craved it more. As other all-star formats are dying a slow death,
they have manipulated the rules.
Hockey has never felt more alive. What a time to be alive. One more game to decide the victor, but it's clear with four nations, we've all won.
Ron, that was the greatest start to a hockey game ever.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And, you know, hockey certainly is about championships and going after medals. It's also about family. And if you were watching our Four Nations coverage, you may have seen some spots, part of the campaign for the Heart and Strokes February Heart Month campaign, which shines a spotlight on CHD, congenital heart disease. And it's something that, you know, someone that I've had the pleasure of interviewing in the past, Nick Foligno, knows really well. Nick and his wife, Janelle, have talked openly about the fact that as first-time parents to their daughter, Milana, in 2013, it's something they dealt with. And you know Nick Foligno as one of the best players in the league, 35th captain of the Chicago Blackhawks. But what you don't know is when he was looking forward to meeting his daughter, something that every parent dreams of, he found out that Milana failed her pulse examiner test several times and there was something wrong with his heart. So now he's speaking out to make sure that all people understand the critical care that's needed and that there are resources out there. So I caught up with Nick and Janelle during this time where we had a bit of a break from NHL hockey. I had a conversation that's much more important than some of the great competition that we saw. It's about the great medical professionals that were in their life and how they want to spread the word during Heart and Stroke Month. Let's go deep. So thank you both for doing this. And I'm really interested to learn more about the story and how you've helped others by illuminating the story. But I want to start with something that many people experience, and that's being first-time parents. Take me back to that time, what the emotions and feelings were like knowing that you're about to bring a child into the world.
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak from a father's perspective. I think, you know, I was thrilled as a young dad. I think that's something that, you know, Janelle and I always wanted to be, was young parents. And in this game especially, you kind of think about, as a kid growing up in the game, going to the rink with your dad and all those little experiences that I was really excited to have with my child. And Janelle and I didn't find out the sex of the baby. We wanted to be surprised at birth. And, you know, lo and behold, we had a beautiful baby girl. And Milana is her name. And she you know, doused us with a lot of surprises. But I just remember being so thrilled. Janelle had an amazing pregnancy. It was really a special thing to go through. And I think also just how excited your teammates usually are for you as you get closer to the day and the big day comes. And then, you know, the texts and the, you know, congratulations and, yeah, it just felt like a, you know, another phase in life, and really excited to take on that that responsibility as a father. You know, it was a thrill of a lifetime for sure.
So when most kids come into the world, and I remember being the one sending this message to the extended village, you know, that message is baby's here, mother and baby are healthy and happy. At what point did you all realize that that wasn't the case in this case?
Yeah, it definitely felt like that from the beginning. Nick certainly sent that text out. Yeah. And so then 24 hours in, when they started to do all the newborn testing and Nick left to go on the road with his team and everybody was in a great spot, I was feeling great. And we did think that Milano was doing great. And it came to a big surprise for us when they were letting us know that she was failing her oxygen test in her blood. It's a test that at the time they were only doing in a few states in America, that they would test the oxygen level in the child's blood to see how the heart was functioning. And she failed the test pretty significantly when they did it twice. And so it was only at that point, 24 hours in, where we realized that something could be wrong. And they started to do more tests and follow up. And it was at that point that, you know, we kind of had to start letting people know that maybe that wasn't necessarily the case. Maybe there was something that might be wrong with her at the time. And it happened really quickly after that.
What a blessing you happen to be in one of those states. So I'm sure the mind starts wandering. What was the original diagnosis?
I mean, that was probably the hardest part. And I'm sure anyone that's ever dealt with, you know, a medical diagnosis understands that, you know, it's kind of a scramble at first. There's not really a cut and dry, especially with a newborn or, you know, any real situation medically. You're fighting for answers. The doctors are trying to figure things out. To what extent the severity of the disease or whatever your child's dealing with. So it was a little bit hectic for a few days. I remember already being, you know, anxious and scared and you're not really having a ton of answers because, you know, there's so many different things they had to check and time. And but ultimately she was diagnosed with mitral valve arcade or regurgitation. And, essentially her mitral valve just never fully developed in her heart. And it's the valve that takes the blood from the lungs to the heart. And so a lot of, as you can imagine, the blood was rushing back into the lungs because it was leaking so violently that it was essentially causing Milana to suffocate, you know, while she was breathing. She wasn't able to breathe very well. And, you know, if it continued to go on, you know, she would unfortunately pass. So very urgent matter. You know, one that was pretty hard. I'll never forget and get the image of, you know, following the ambulance as parents. You know, you have the empty car seat in the back and you're supposed to have this wonderful ride back home. And now you're following an ambulance to the Children's Hospital in Columbus. And, you know, you got my wife who's fresh out of delivering a baby next to me. And, you know, that reality of what we're about to face and not really knowing, it's a scary time. And thankfully, though, you get hope when you meet these incredible doctors that we walked into and they get Milana stable and they're trying to find answers. And even though maybe it's not the pace you'd like, you really do feel thankful that you're in a place that can help you and give you some sort of comfort and of knowing that they're doing the best they can to help your daughter. And we were very blessed and thankful for that situation for sure.
During the pregnancy and the birth and in some ways afterwards, the father is sometimes a bit helpless. And I imagine with that image in the ambulance, you both are feeling somewhat helpless. You talked about the comfort and the answers. When those started to come, what did that look like? Were there action steps you could take towards a resolution?
Yeah, you know, it's probably better to answer this one. She's the real reason why we ended up moving over to Boston. So you'll hear the story now.
Well, it's just like the action step. I'm very much a type A action step planner type person. And so that's exactly where my mind went right away. It was like, okay, well, what are the steps? What do we need to do? I remember a lot of our family and friends asking, you know, how we were doing it, how we were even surviving this at this point, not knowing what was going on and how it would end up with Milana. But that was my mindset. It was like, what are the steps? And not really knowing exactly the steps because it was a lot of back and forth with the doctors. didn't want to perform surgery because she was so small and young. They weren't very confident in the outcome of the surgery, and they also weren't sure exactly which direction to take if they were to even perform the surgery, because the mitral valve doesn't have a lot of options for a replacement. And with this specific congenital heart defect, it is often a mechanical valve that they will have to put in, but that has its own risks and typically isn't put in at such a small size and young age. And so that's when we were put in contact with somebody who is well connected at Boston Children's Hospital, and it happened to be that they were doing an experimental surgery on this specific defect with the mitral valve, and they had been using a different sort of valve that the surgeon, Dr. Sitaram Amani at Boston Children's Hospital, was then working on himself before implementing it into the child's heart. And it seemed really scary at the time, but it just felt like a step that I knew we had to take to give her a fighting chance, because the other option wasn't looking very good. It was pretty grim. And so
it's kind of a leap of faith in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely a leap of faith. And we asked for a transfer to Boston Children's, and we had amazing doctors in Columbus, and they helped facilitate that. And we were able to get her transferred to Boston Children's, where she then had the experimental surgery, and she was actually number 17 in the world to receive this procedure. And that kind of felt serendipitous in itself, where it was like, this was like a lucky number per se in our family. So that was kind of quick steps. It all happened within 3 weeks, and she had her first surgery at 21 days old. But those were the action steps, I guess.
Yeah, and as we get into it more, I'm sure, like, you know, Janelle kind of pointed out to it, but it was actually a friend of my sister's who kind of gave us the idea of Boston. Her daughter had some health issues in kind of a similar fashion, and kind of funny how it is word of mouth. It is the village. It is those people that, you know, help you through a time of need. And I think it's a reason why Janelle and I felt such a calling after Milana got healthy to get involved, because we understood how important that gesture was. Something as small as even just a conversation really changed the trajectory for Milana's care, and, you know, made a huge difference in her, you know, chance of survival and thriving. So, you know, it's those moments that you kind of go back to as you're able to reflect. And in the moment, you're in the crap, but then you get to reflect and realize how impactful that really is.
Well, I know the number 17 is the Foligno family number, but it obviously has some pretty special significance. I expect you're going to always want to have that one on your jersey and close to your heart. It's amazing, one, that you advocated for your child. And I know in my family, moms know best in terms of, is this different, or is this something that you can just wait on? But also, it's great that you decided to share in the moment with your village, but now you're sharing to the greater village. What's your hope in sharing your personal story to try and help others?
Yeah, that's actually something that in the beginning we struggled with, because we really felt that we wanted to keep it private between our family and our close network. We did struggle with sharing it at the beginning, even just the fact that she had been sick. I think it was just hard for us to wrap our minds around, and then having that be public was difficult. But then the following, which came with, you know, the working with different foundations and the money that we wanted to give back, and just even making that public, we struggled with. But we came to realize that, like Nick mentioned with the awareness piece, it's so important to be able to share that information about congenital heart defects. And, you know, even for ourselves, we didn't realize how common they were when we were brought into this life with a child with a heart defect. And so we just felt it was important to be able to share, to create that awareness, but also to maybe motivate somebody else to step up and help. And so aligning with different foundations, and specifically right now the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada. We just want to spread the word for this awareness and all the amazing work that they're doing, and help others step up and highlight what the doctors and nurses are doing, and just want to be involved as much as we can.
And I think it's empowering to our daughter too. You know, that's the thing that we didn't really realize. She's getting to take a hold of her own journey and not look at it as a way of, oh man, look what I'm dealing with. Like, poor me. She's actually empowered by it herself now. She talks about it. She inspires others. You know, Janelle wrote a children's book in honor of Milana, and, you know, she's so proud of it. It's a beautiful thing that just started off, honestly, just for Milana. And then we realized, like, how many people would benefit from just having a story that they could read to their child in a hospital bed, or be able to gift to a family member who is going through it. And Milana now signs the book and writes little personal messages to the people that we send them to. And it's just beautiful to watch her kind of become this, you know, beacon of light for a lot of people. And I think that, as parents, has been really inspiring, and probably not even something we really thought of at the beginning, but have really embraced now. We do hospital visits and try to bring her along. And, you know, so it's really, as much as we've tried to give and make sure that we're giving back for what's been given to us, which is a chance to have a family, it's actually really strengthened our family bond and allowed us to have so many other things because of that, and opportunities to really show our kids how lucky they are in life too. And even something scary, she's come out on top, and we continue to fight through, and I think it's inspired our entire family.
You mentioned your daughter. How is she? Has it been smooth sailing since the original procedure? And how is she in terms of her heart, her health, and her physical nature now?
It hasn't been smooth sailing, but we knew that. We knew from the very beginning that this wouldn't be a one-and-done situation. Unfortunately, it's just the nature of the specific heart defect that she does have, and that's the case for most heart kids. They have this lifelong journey ahead of them, and whether it's through surgeries or just constant monitoring. But for Milana specifically, she has had several procedures, and two open heart surgeries, and some other surgeries that they were able to amazingly perform through a catheter in her leg, which is another full side of things with how amazing the advancements in the technology have been throughout the years, even from when she was born to what's available now at 11 years old. And she follows up every 3 months with her cardiologists, and she has a really good team of doctors behind her. And this is a lifelong journey for her. And unfortunately, we don't really know what that entails as we go along, but we've, like Nick mentioned, empowered her, and she is really positive about it all. And, you know, she knows that she's a fighter and she's going to continue to fight, and we're optimistic about it all. And we just take it one step at a time, and we cross every bridge when we get there. And we have an amazing support system around us, and we trust the doctors, and we just take it one step at a time.
One bridge you crossed was being in Boston for a couple of years and having the ability to play there. What was that time and that experience like, given the history with the city?
Yeah, I actually was, we said it was a really serendipitous thing to be able to come back and play for a city that, like I said, gave us a chance of being a family, right? Like the doctors at Boston Children's, especially Dr. Sitaram Imani and Dr. Wayne Turetsky, are two people that we're just forever indebted to. For giving us a chance. And I think, can I go back and play for their hometown team was really special for me, was really neat for Milana, because I think too, for Milana, every time we go to Boston, it was a checkup or a surgery, or now it was home for a few years, you know, and she got to really ingrain herself in the community, and it wasn't maybe so scary for her anymore. It wasn't always, oh, we're going to Boston. It was, oh, this is where I'm from. This is where I live. This is, you know, I know this place now. I have an attachment, not just to the hospital, but to the city. And we really enjoyed our time there. It was a special team that we were on, and probably should have won a cup, but we'll have that on a whole other podcast one day. But it was just really, really special for me to go back and kind of give thanks to a place that, like I said, gave me a chance at being a father and us at being parents and a family. And then we really genuinely enjoyed that. And it's kind of neat that we'll always have Boston near and dear to our heart and now really know the city inside and out.
And it was also another timing of being at the right place at the right time. Kind of funny how these things have worked out, but it's just, we have faith in that and we think things happen for a reason. And the first year when Nick had signed there, it happened to be that Milana did require a surgery and she did require to be at Boston Children's more often than not. And we were there. It was home for us at the time. And so it worked out really well. And we were able to, you know, be home and travel to the surgery and things like that. It was just really, really funny how it worked out for that. But just to have her followed and be close to them was nice.
You know, with a couple of young kids, I feel like I've heard a lot of children ailments because my wife is a Google doctor looking up everything and getting super scared every time something happens. But this is one that I hadn't heard of. How prevalent is it?
Well, Milana's specific diagnosis is pretty rare in the sense that often children who have mitral valve regurgitation will also have another portion of their heart that requires attention. It's called Schoen's complex. So she has kind of like a version of it. And so hers specifically was pretty rare, but one in 100 babies are born with a congenital heart disease. So it's actually pretty prevalent. And like I said, it's not something that we were aware of at the time. But now we're continuing to learn more and more about the different heart defects that there are and spreading awareness and just, you know, trying to connect ourselves with that community.
And I think too, one thing we've learned through it all is actually how underfunded pediatrics is, right? Like it's actually not, it's obviously more medicine and money is pumped into the adults and, you know, and it's amazing. Even just the children's pediatric, like, you know, heart disease and all the things, they're very underfunded and it's something we've learned. And I think that's what's inspired us is like, even for our daughter, they said about 5 years before she was born, she probably wouldn't have survived. They just didn't have anything available to really give her a quality of life. She would have had a few surgeries and even that would have been risky and just, you know, going under anesthesia and how many they would have needed to give her in a short amount of time. So, you know, you realize quickly how fortunate you are that, you know, the advancements in technology and in research and in funding, they matter. They matter. And there's really smart people that are doing really incredible things that are paving the way for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. And you only hope that, you know, more amazing advancements happen. And, but I think that's kind of, you know, where we felt, you know, this journey has kind of led us.
You're certainly going to hear from a lot of more people who've had similar journeys, but up until this point, what are the types of stories that you hear now that you've started to become more public about it?
Oh, I mean, it's crazy how many different people, even just some, what is it, 6 degrees of separation from certain people that you didn't really know, friend of a friend, and they're going through something similar or, you know, and you're able to offer real insight. And I think that's what, you know, Janelle and I are really proud of is, you know, not so many times it's the story, it's just the help that you're able to give a family because you've been there. You've actually sat in that bed. You've sat in that really uncomfortable chair next to that bed. You slept overnight when the alarms are going off and you don't know what's going on with your daughter. So there's some realness to our conversations with families and, you know, and the stories they share with us. And you can actually, you know, get through to them and give them hope. And that's all you need is you need a glimmer of hope, just like we had at our lowest moment. And I think that's what we really appreciate that we're able to provide sometimes. And sometimes it's just sitting there and being with them. Listen, not everyone turns out great. And it crushes us and also makes us realize how lucky we are, even with our story and how scary it was, how lucky we are that our daughter actually does have a good, you know, prognosis and a good quality of life. And even though we're, you know, we're going to continue to follow and fight and have her journey be, you know, a battle, you know, there's families that have dealt with heartbreak, and you sit there and be with them and be present and know what they went through. And so I think that's what makes it hard and beautiful all in the same time. I think it's what continues us to continue to fight and make a difference and not just have this be like a one-off where you, oh, okay, we did our part. And now, no, this is every day for us because we live it every day. We look at our daughter and we watch how she grows, and we know that, you know, at any moment it can change. Right. And we have to be ready for that. And so I think it's a great reminder that we immerse ourselves in it and stay connected with people and allow our story to help motivate and educate. And I think that's the biggest thing is throughout this whole thing is the education of learning more about congenital heart defects and what can be done. And that's why I'm you know, so happy we team with the Heart and Stroke Foundation in Canada and what they're doing and educating people and bringing awareness. And it just feels like part of our journey and why, you know, God put this in our hands to deal with. And hopefully we can be a beacon of light like our daughter has been for a lot of people.
No question. You've been a beacon of light in a couple different ways. I can't let you go because I'll get my listeners in Sudbury and Buffalo upset if I didn't ask you about the foundation that's not just the nuclear family working on it like this one, but the extended family with your sisters and your brother and your dad and the Janice Foligno Foundation, and an update on how that's going and how they can support that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a really inspiring thing. And I think that's what, you know, has made it so special for Janelle and I to start the Hearts Playbook, because we've seen the impact that we've been able to have with the Janice Foligno Foundation and, you know, and keeping our mom's name alive and you know, the people, the stories that we've heard from them about how it's made a difference. We've obviously based a lot of it on research, and, you know, there's a great, incredible center in Sudbury, Ontario, that we really try to support. We try to keep local. We're, you know, a Northern Ontario community that, you know, for some reasons is forgotten in some ways, but the incredible things that those doctors are doing up there and, you know, and trying to, you know, bring help to the House of Kin, which houses people that are dealing with cancer. We also are big advocates for the hospice because we've spent time there and understand that, like I said, not every single time is it a great ending. But you want people to have dignity in their final moments, which is what my mom was given. And we were big advocates for the hospice, the Valley Hospice and Maison Hospice in Sudbury. And it's an ongoing battle. We all know it's one of the worst diseases in the world. We're really proud that we were able to raise another, I think, $75,000 this year. And we're going to put that into research again and to some great causes. And our fight will continue. We owe it to our mother. We owe it to the people that rely on us to continue to try to move the awareness and the research and the battle forward on cancer. And we're very proud and humbled by the support that we've been given. I think that's something that we always go back to. None of this matters without the support of others and people that believe in our mission. And we don't take that lightly. And I think as a family, it's really bonded us over a really tough moment in our lives. And we feel like we keep our mom's legacy alive. And it's really fun to talk about with even our kids who never got to meet her, but they all know so much about her. And I think that's been a beautiful thing too.
Well, I think fight is the operative word. I don't know if you or Marcus are the better fighter on the ice. And you could have that conversation in a different pod.
That's
when
me
he's
all day,
here,
you know it.
When he's here to defend himself. But certainly it's clear the women that have been in your life, from your mom to now your wife to your daughter, are all fighters. So thank you for sharing the story. Thank you for the work that you are doing and continue to do. And if there's ever anything that we can do to help, me personally and us here at Sportsnet, don't hesitate to ask.
No, you guys are great. Thank you for allowing us to come on and share our story. Appreciate it. Great catching up.
Thanks so much to Nick and Janelle for their candor and sharing their story. In the bio notes of this podcast, you can click on the Heart and Stroke Foundation's website. There you have resources, information, if you want to support or if you need support and looking for help, because this story is a bit close to home for you. And I mentioned I was in Boston this week, and there were initiatives going on during the Four Nations. Essentially, this became the NHL's All-Star, and there's always philanthropic endeavors that the league is a part of. And I was able to witness a really cool one around sledge hockey and got up close and personal with our Paralympic athletes who are going to be competing for gold in sledge hockey in Italy next year. In the rivalry between Canada and the USA extended not just to TD Garden, there's also a huge match in Kasabuski Arena in Saugus, just outside of downtown Boston. It's an accessible community rink where we had the Christopher Reeve Hockey Classic. Christopher Reeve, obviously, many know as Superman, and his family has given so much to the Paralympic athletic movement. We had an exhibition between USA and Canada. Bad news is that the Americans won 4-3 with a late goal, but everyone won because the day before that, there was a tri-sledge hockey event that was free for lots of people, boys and girls, to come out and understand the sport, see it. Even I got in a sled and tried it. And I caught up with Tyler McGregor, captain of Team Canada. He's been on the team since he was 18, who taught me, well, taught is doing a lot of work, tried to teach me how to sledge. And I'll tell you, it is a workout. They are true athletes. And I also caught up with Kim Davis, executive vice president for the league in social impact, growth initiatives, and legislative affairs. But why this event was taking place, why it was important, how difficult an athletic endeavor it was. And it was really a scene. Kyle Dubas, Mark Messier all came out to see the tri-sledge event. So you're going to hear from Kim Davis first, then captain of Team Canada, Tyler McGregor, on the sledge event and the Christopher Reeve Classic and its importance.
So Kim, whenever you and your team calls, I come. Where are we today and what is this event?
This is probably one of the most important events that we have done of recent days in the youth hockey space. The ability for these amazing para players to showcase during their practice for youth in the Boston area is both a delight, and who could have imagined that we would have Team USA and Team Hockey on the eve of the Four Nations battle between Canada and U.S. We could not have curated it any better.
It's a busy time in the league calendar, not really a true break, but in a break of the action, why was putting on this tri-sledge event important?
Well, you know, we have been long committed to the special hockey community. And to have our Industry Growth Fund kids, our Learn to Play kids in the area, experience trying sled, understanding the athleticism involved in it. Also to be able to have kids who have some form of paralysis to come and to see themselves. You and I both understand how important representation is. So for them to see themselves in these amazing athletes, it's just part of our continued effort to grow the sport and to grow the game.
To be able to have events like this, you need spaces like this, accessible arenas and understandings of where they are and how you can get involved. How can we continue the conversation to make sure that people who want to be a part of it have those opportunities?
Yeah, adaptive hockey is both expensive, and not every rink, as you point out, has the capability for it. And so when we decided we were going to put this on, the first order of business was trying to find a place. And there were only a couple of rinks, one at Boston University, which was not available to us, and then, of course, this rink here. And as you said, to be able to have a rink that adapts to the sleds and have the locker rooms that can adapt to it is not for the faint of heart. And so we were able to do it, and we are so appreciative of this rink for hosting this important event.
Everyone is excited for USA Canada best on best, but the spotlight that has will be shone also on the Christopher Reeve Classic and Canada USA, yes. Also best on best. Why is it important to have the league's megaphone showcase that event?
Well, it really is two important megaphones. We had a conversation some months ago with Will Reeve to talk about having our NHL U.S. Foundation partner with the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, and to do it around this important Sled Classic where we bring the best of Paralympians together and showcasing them tomorrow night, and to be able to showcase the amazing research that the Reeve Foundation is doing to end paralysis alongside our U.S. NHL Foundation, working to try to build stronger, more vibrant communities. You couldn't have a better and more powerful pair together.
Well, I'm excited to be a part of this Tri Sledge event. The word that's doing a lot of work in that sentence is try.
Yes.
Because I don't know how good I'm going to be, but I have an appreciation for the level of athleticism. I'm really, really excited.
It's amazing to watch the players and to realize just how difficult you can imagine it is on that single blade on that sled, but they are amazing athletes.
So, Captain Canada, Tyler, what did I get myself into? What is this event here today?
This is a Tri Sled Hockey for free. I think you're in for a treat. You're gonna have some fun. It will be a challenge, that's for certain. But yeah, we're on the ice. A bunch of people are trying sled hockey for the first time, or para hockey as we call it in Canada. It's a great day. It's a great day to spend in this freezing cold rink.
Why are events like this important?
They're so important. Just to increase exposure of our sport. First and foremost, introduce new people to our sport, potential new young players, but also to have people like yourself, the media members here. Like, that's an important aspect of growth for us, and we appreciate any opportunity we have to, whether that's introduce people firsthand or introduce people watching at home to what we think is an extremely special sport.
How are you introduced to the sport?
I actually lost my leg to cancer in 2010. I'd played hockey since I was 3 years old. And so after that experience, I was looking for a new opportunity to be a high-performance athlete, to compete, to be a part of a team. And I was actually introduced by a former coach. I started playing just outside or in London, Ontario, not far from where I grew up. And I've never looked back since. It was a difficult learning experience, but I couldn't imagine my life without it now.
In every arena across our country, there are learn to skate programs. But I've never heard of programs teaching you to do what you do, become at a high level. How difficult is it to not only learn how to play the sport, but get to the level that you're at?
It's pretty difficult. First and foremost, like transitioning from stand-up hockey, there's not a ton of transferable skills in terms of the mechanics and how it's played. Obviously, you play with your upper body, play with two sticks rather than one. So learning to be ambidextrous, learning some different skill sets, and then applying that to different systems within our game, it's a challenge. And yeah, it makes it difficult that there's not necessarily the same infrastructure within our sport that there is in the minor hockey system in Canada. So you kind of, in many ways, you have to practice once a week with your team and then go home and sit in your basement or in your garage in your sled and try to teach yourself the skill set or try to find any ice time that you possibly can. But that's an exciting part of the future for us, is that we have an opportunity to be a part of building that legacy.
Part of building the legacy is buildings. We don't have a lot of accessible arenas. How can we move the needle on that part of the equation?
Well, that's why I think for us, like, to be able to retrofit an arena, I think that scares a lot of people away in terms of the cost. And it really isn't that large of a cost to do so. And then in addition to that, I think what I would encourage people to do is, when you think proactively about making buildings accessible, what you really determine is that there's no added cost to making a building or a facility accessible for everyone. And so as we progress through the next number of years, well into the future, I would just encourage people across the country to have that foresight, to think proactively about making sure that everyone can access it, so that our sport can play, stand-up hockey players can play, blind hockey players can play. Everybody is welcome into the facility and has the opportunity to enjoy this incredible game.
We're getting close to the 2026 Olympics. I feel like in Paris, I saw so much more coverage and attention to the Paralympics. What are you looking forward to in terms of having that spotlight for the Winter Olympics in Italy?
Yeah, I mean, I've had the opportunity to be a part of three Paralympic Games, and you're so right. Like, we just continue to get more and more coverage, more exposure, more spotlight on not just our sport, but other Paralympic sports as well. And, you know, of course we'd like to snap our fingers and have the equivalent coverage, but, like, it's also nice to build things brick by brick. And we're so fortunate that we have the opportunity to compete first and foremost. But, you know, looking ahead to the Milan Games, like, we expect there to be more and more coverage. What a celebration, especially after the Paris Games and all the excitement around those games and the performances of our Canadian athletes. Like, we're looking to go to Milan and put on the same game, same performance, excuse me. And we think that should be shared with everyone in our country and around the world.
And lastly, when you get into a sled, what's that feeling like for you? How important is this stage and platform for you as an athlete and a person?
Well, I think first and foremost, like, sport is such an important venue for life. Like, I've learned more from my experience in sport than I don't know if I would have in many other places. It's given me many beautiful moments of joy and so many great moments, so many great friendships and relationships. But it's also challenged me in ways and presented a lot of heartbreaking moments that you really learn and grow from and get better from and try to navigate and adapt to. So I think that is a special aspect of getting in a sled, one that I don't know if you can find. And just to be on this stage, to be at Four Nations, I mean, we're seeing the best of the best in our sport, and we're so grateful to have the opportunity to also showcase the best of the best in our sport. I mean, the Canada-US rivalry is alive and well and always is in our sport, just as we've seen so far in the Four Nations, just as we see all the time in women's hockey. So we're pretty excited to share that stage. Obviously, the NHL is the pinnacle of our sport, and we feel pretty lucky to be here.
As do I. This sled gives you joy. It gives me abdominal pain. But I can't wait to learn as much as I can from you. Can you teach me your ways?
Absolutely. I'd love to. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Thanks so much to Kim and Tyler. And it's important that if we are going to be a great hockey nation and the game is going to continue to grow, that's not just best on best as we perceive it in the NHL. It's best on best in all disciplines, and sledge is a big part of that and will continue to be, hopefully, because you heard how important it is and what it means to the people playing it. This tournament meant a lot to all of us as Canadians, given everything that is going on and, if we're being honest, the threat on our sovereignty and our freedom. I tackled those issues because I haven't seen a better example of exhibiting patriotism and a time where it was needed more than what I saw in Boston over the span of the last week. So as I leave you, here's my essay on what that gold meant, not just for Hockey Canada, but all of Canada.
It's going to be a whole bunch of small little moments in the game that's going to lead to one big one in the end.
Yes, sir! They did it in hostile territory. They showed heart and humility and togetherness, some traits we could all use right now. Maybe they not like us after all, because we're champs!
Sends it back to the young defenseman. He finds McKinnon on the move. McKinnon scores! Nathan McKinnon with the icebreaker in the championship game. And it's got back to Nathan McKinnon. Sam Bennett has tied it.
I've always known we were proud as Canadians, but I didn't recall sports ever being a better platform to show it than what we just witnessed. So enough from me, Canada, listen to you. Oh, Canada, for real.